The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Next, you're holding up the line, ma'am.
What did you say?
You're next in line for the water slide, ma'am. Feet forward and enjoy the ride.
Okay, dearie, this does look fun. You've melted me. I've melted.
The Wicked Witch of the West on a water slide? Surprising. What's not surprising? How much you could save by switching to GEICO.
See what you've done. Oh!
GEICO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The U.S. and its allies launch precision strikes in Syria.
The move was in response to last weekend's chemical weapons attack.
James Comey takes aim at President Trump.
He describes Mr. Trump as a liar and a bully and compares his inner circle to the mafia.
And the fallout from a raid targeting the president's personal attorney.
The president continued his attacks on the Justice Department.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend with U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria.
President Trump ordered airstrikes on targets inside Syria Friday night.
A combined operation with the armed forces of France and the United Kingdom is now underway.
The move was in response to last weekend's chemical weapons attack in the rebel-held town of Douma.
Clearly, the Assad regime did not get the message last year. This time, our allies and we have struck harder.
The targets that were struck and destroyed were specifically associated with the Syrian regime's chemical weapons program.
From the start, the U.S., the U.K., and France suspected the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was to blame.
It is about a limited and targeted strike that does not further escalate tensions in the region.
The purpose of our actions tonight is to establish a strong deterrent against the production, spread, and use of chemical weapons.
The Kremlin cautioned the White House against taking military action. Russia vowed to stand by Syria and warned that the situation could escalate. Hours before the airstrike, a final attempt at diplomacy at the UN went nowhere.
Russia was supposed to guarantee that Assad wouldn't use chemical weapons, and Russia did the opposite.
In reply, the Russian ambassador accused the U.S. of threatening to unleash chaos in the Middle East. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, the White House.
Correspondent Holly Williams has more on the deadly attack.
Survivors in Douma smelled strongly of chlorine, according to medics, a chemical that can be deadly in confined spaces and especially toxic for children. Many of the dead seem to have collapsed with no obvious signs of injury. We spoke with one medic by phone who told us he treated around 70 of the victims, but for his own safety asked that we not identify him.
Everyone who had a cough, a bloody cough, after that died. One of them was my patient who was about 35. I tried to save him.
The Syrian regime is accused of using chlorine as a weapon many times before, and this alleged chemical bombardment comes as the regime attacks the rebel stronghold of eastern Ghouta. But the regime, as always, denies it's used chemical weapons. Its ally Russia was even more categorical and called the allegations fake news. But the carnage lays bare the proxy war being fought in Syria. Iran and Russia back the regime, regardless of its atrocities. And now the U.S. must again decide how to respond.
A year ago, the U.S. responded to a sarin nerve agent attack in Syria by launching nearly 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles targeting a Syrian regime airbase. Holly Williams, CBS News, Istanbul.
On Friday, President Trump called former FBI Director James Comey a proven leaker and liar and an untruthful slimeball. On Twitter, he wrote it was an honor to fire him. It comes as Comey's memoir goes on sale.
James Comey's disdain for the president jumps off the pages of his new memoir. He describes Mr. Trump as a liar and a bully and compares his inner circle to the mafia, quote, lying about all things, large and small, in service to some code of loyalty that put the organization above morality and above the truth.
I think it's very sad what they've done with this fake dossier. It was made up
Comey also describes the president's fixation with the now infamous election dossier, which includes unverified allegations of Mr. Trump's involvement with Russian prostitutes, allegation the president denies. Unprompted, he brought up what he called the golden showers thing, Comey writes, adding that the president asked him to investigate the salacious charges in the document because, quote, it bothered him if there was even a 1% chance his wife, Melania, thought it was true.
Good morning.
Comey also defends his role in the election.
The FBI is completing its investigation and referring the matter to the Department of Justice for a prosecutive decision.
After originally clearing Hillary Clinton in the email investigation, Comey implies politics may have played a role in his decision to reopen the probe 11 days before the election. Because I was making decisions in an environment where Hillary Clinton was sure to be the next president, my concern about making her an illegitimate president by concealing the restarted investigation bore greater weight, he writes. The former FBI director is not without his own critics. He has come under fire from both parties for being too political, and the FBI had to amend inaccurate portions of his testimony last May. In advance of the book's release, Republican allies of the president are firing back, calling Comey a liar and a leaker.
I was appalled by what Director Comey did.
Promoting attack ads on the website liancomey.com.
White House correspondent Major Garrett. Reports say the president considered firing Special Counsel Robert Mueller in December. In a tweet Thursday, he called it fake news. It comes as even members of his own party raise concerns he may take action against Mueller or Deputy Attorney General Ron Rosenstein.
Reiterating a position the White House has taken since last June, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said President Trump believes he could fire the special counsel if he wanted to.
Certainly believes he has the power to do so.
Some legal experts disagree. Will the president try to fire Robert Mueller? Sanders wouldn't say. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, The White House.
The president's also criticizing an FBI raid on his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, who's under criminal investigation.
In addition to seizing documents related to two women who claim they had affairs with the president, investigators also were looking for records related to the Access Hollywood tape in which Mr. Trump was heard making vulgar comments about women.
Hi,
Mr. Trump, how are you?
It's not clear what role, if any, Cohen played regarding the tape, which was made public about a month before the election. But for a judge to issue a search warrant for records, prosecutors would have to show that the records are connected to a possible crime. The president continued his attack on the Justice Department, tweeting, much of the bad blood with Russia is caused by the fake and corrupt Russia investigation.
The Cohen raids have stalled ongoing negotiations between the White House and special counsel over a possible interview with the president. While the special counsel is not overseeing the investigation into Mr. Cohen, sources tell CBS that the president is angry about those raids and less inclined to agree to an interview at this time. Paula Reed, CBS News, Washington.
On Friday, President Trump made an unexpected announcement. He pardoned former aide to former Vice President Dick Cheney, Scooter Libby. He was convicted in 2007 of obstruction of justice and lying to the FBI, who was investigating how the name of a CIA official was leaked to the press. Former President George W. Bush commuted his prison sentence. Still to come, Mike Pompeo takes another step towards his confirmation to be Secretary of State.
Pompeo's goals at the hearing to become Secretary of State was to convince senators he intends to reestablish the State Department's relevance in national security policy.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. CIA Director Mike Pompeo faced the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Thursday for his confirmation hearing to be Secretary of State. Correspondent Cammie McCormick reports he faced questions focused on the Iran nuclear deal.
Asked if Iran is in compliance with the nuclear agreement.
With the information that I've been provided, I've seen no evidence that they are not in compliance.
Mike Pompeo has been an opponent of the deal, but said he will work to fix it.
There is no doubt that this administration's policy, and my view, is that the solution to preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, to finding ourselves in the same place we are in North Korea, in Iran, is through diplomacy.
One of Pompeo's goals at the hearing to become Secretary of State was to convince senators he intends to reestablish the State Department's relevance in national security policy. Cammie McCormick, CBS News, Washington.
Pompeo also admitted to being interviewed in the special counsel's Russia investigation, but declined to comment on the Russia probe. New Mexico Democratic Senator Tom Udall sits on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator, what do you think of Pompeo's testimony?
He probably did a fair job at presenting his side. I was very disappointed that he would not take on the president when it came to the firing of Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein and also Special Prosecutor Mueller. I think those are such large issues that while his nomination is pending, while he's the director of the CIA, something like that happens that's a threat to our Constitution and puts us in a constitutional crisis that he wouldn't even speak up. I mean, I said, you know, you should, would you resign? He says, no, I wouldn't resign. No, I wouldn't take the Secretary of State post. Would you do anything? He didn't give any answer of anything he would do.
Senator, you also asked Pompeo about the U.S. presence in Cuba. That's now just a skeleton staff at the embassy in Havana following mysterious attacks on diplomats. Here's how he responded.
We will, consistent with making sure we can keep these folks safe, we will build out a team there that will deliver American diplomacy to Cuba in a way that represents the finest of America.
Now, reports say among those first attacked in Cuba were U.S. intelligence officers, and it's thought CIA Director Pompeo was involved in the decision to close the CIA station in Havana. Do you think he would really want to rebuild the U.S. presence there after the action he likely took?
Well, I'm happy with his statement. The thing that disturbs me a lot about testimony to get a job is that frequently you see within 10 days or even 2 weeks, they reverse the position in terms of their actual actions when they take over the job they're aspiring to. And so if he stuck with the idea that he's going to fill the positions and he's going to have a robust diplomacy within Cuba and they're not going to be in a retaliatory phase, that would be a good thing. But it looks to me that the discouraging thing, and President Trump is really, on all of his statements, rolling us back to the old 50-year-old failed policy. I mean, that's where President Trump's coming from, is we're full embargo, we're not going to deal with these guys, they're horrible communists, and we aren't going to engage the Cuban people. I think we should be engaging the Cuban people as President Obama did, opening it up, trying to do everything we can.
Well, then do you believe Pompeo?
I don't know if I believe him or not. The thing I've learned in Washington over the years, it's the deeds that count. And so I'm hoping that he will perform like he said he will perform, open the embassy, do honest diplomacy, because if he does that, he's going to learn that the Cuban people really like Americans, and they want a good relationship, and they appreciate what President Obama did in terms of opening things up and empowering the Cuban people and opening up the private sector.
I also want to ask you about something closer to home for you, the president's request. New Mexico's governor send National Guard troops to help protect the U.S.-Mexico border. How long should those troops be stationed there?
Well, first of all, I stand with New Mexico families and businesses who oppose President Trump's desire to militarize the border. And I oppose President Trump's effort to build a wildly expensive and ineffective border wall. And that's why I voted against funding for it multiple times. I think the most telling thing here is that the sheriff of Doñana County, which is one of our largest counties in New Mexico, which is on the border, met with Attorney General Sessions, and Sheriff V. Hill says the border isn't experiencing the crisis the Trump administration claims. And he says building a wall and sending National Guard troops would be a waste of money. If you look at previous examples of when we sent National Guard, under President Bush, the numbers of people apprehended coming in were much, much higher than they are now. Same true with President Obama. And President Trump, the numbers are down dramatically for 2018. So I'm going to take the approach that we need to really scrutinize this. We need to make sure as to what jobs they're going to be doing. If they're moving into areas that have to do with port of entry to help the trade between us and Mexico, that's one thing. If they're moving into areas they shouldn't be in of actual law enforcement for the military on the border, then I'm going to be very, very skeptical.
But you have a Republican governor. I spoke with the Archbishop of Santa Fe about immigration a couple of weeks ago. He's echoing the same concerns. Where's the disconnect then?
Well, the disconnect is that we're in a high rhetoric situation. And this is where President Trump's been all along, stirring people up, appealing to their fears, doing everything he can to try to get people to make a decision on fear rather than on the true situation that exists today. And I think when my local law enforcement people that are there on the border think this is a bad idea, I'm siding with them.
New Mexico Senator Tom Udall, thank you.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Take care. Bye-bye.
At the center of Capitol Hill's attention for 2 days, Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who faced some 10 hours of questions by lawmakers on the social media network's privacy practices in the wake of the Cambridge Analytica scandal. He apologized but also defended Facebook to Democratic Florida Senator Bill Nelson.
Why didn't you inform those 87 million?
When we learned in 2015 that Cambridge Analytica had bought data from an app developer on Facebook that people had shared it with, we did take action. We took down the app. And we demanded that both the app developer and Cambridge Analytica delete and stop using any data that they had.
Zuckerberg also admitted Facebook's involvement in the special counsel's Russia probe. Then he admitted Wednesday to House lawmakers his personal data was compromised in the mishandling of user information by other companies. Up next, what's next for the House after Speaker Paul Ryan announces his plans to retire from Congress on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up. It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News.
And good evening. Wall Street today signaled its approval of the tax cuts passed by the Republican-controlled Congress.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. The clock is ticking for House Speaker Paul Ryan, who announced he'll retire from Congress after serving out his term next January. Chief Congressional Correspondent Nancy Cordes has more from Capitol Hill.
Mr. Speaker, why are
Paul Ryan will walk away from the most powerful job on Capitol Hill after just 3 years.
I will be setting new priorities in my life.
He gave three reasons for his departure. They are 16, 14, and 13, and they're in Wisconsin, all of them born since he came to Congress in 1999.
My dad died when I was 16, the age my daughter is. And I just don't want to be one of those people looking back at my life thinking I spent more time with my kids when I know if I spend another term, they will only know me as a weekend father.
Ryan was drafted to be speaker in 2015 after conservatives forced out John Boehner. As recently as January, the 48-year-old Ryan insisted he was staying put.
I have no plans of going out anywhere anytime soon.
Today, he claimed the daunting midterm elections and an unpredictable president had nothing to do with his choice. But Ryan is the 24th House Republican to retire this term, a record. And GOP operatives worry that more will follow his lead as polls show the party could lose control of the House in November.
There's a lot of weariness and a lot of exhaustion, frankly.
Pennsylvania's Charlie Dent announced his retirement last year.
Who do you think will be the next speaker?
Oh, boy. Hopefully we won't have to have that conversation until after the election. First, have to hold the majority. Before you can determine whether or not you're going to have a speaker.
California's Kevin McCarthy and Louisiana's Steve Scalise are already vying for Ryan's job.
I have more thoughts on this. I think this is probably not the right time to get into that, but I'll share those thoughts later.
House Republican members said they understood Ryan's desire to live with his family. Still, many of them were stunned. They assumed that his desire to tackle welfare and entitlement reform would compel him to stick around, even in this difficult environment. Nancy Cordes, CBS News, Capitol Hill.
Illinois Democratic Congresswoman Sherry Bustos hasn't had many kind words for her colleague, Paul Ryan. You said you wish you could congratulate him on a job well done. Where has he fallen short?
Oh, gosh, let me count the ways. But let me also say,
in the vein of civility that on a personal level I wish him well. I'm glad he's going to be able to spend more time with his family. On a governmental level and for the sake of our nation, I don't think there's a whole lot of successes that he can point to.
I also want to ask you about harassment in Congress. Has he done enough to combat it?
Well, we have a problem here that we really haven't addressed. Other than to draw attention to it because of the victims, we have to pass meaningful legislation that will allow people who are victims of sexual harassment to know where to turn, to have recourse, and to make sure that the taxpayers' dollars aren't used to bail out members of Congress who have sexually harassed people.
Do you believe he's a friend to the effort to get that done?
Well, I don't think he's been a friend. I don't want to say he's been an enemy of getting that done, but you know, there's a pretty much a strong sense of urgency that we have a problem with sexual harassment in the nation's capital. And you know, here's what I see as the problem. You have Speaker Ryan, a Republican-controlled House, Republican-controlled Senate, a Republican in the White House, and yet we have not debated meaningful legislation under this leadership.
You're part of Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's leadership team, but would you be open to supporting another candidate for House Speaker if Democrats regain control of the House?
Well, I think we have every opportunity to take control of the House again, but I think we ought to look at it more in terms of what is our pledge to the American public that they put faith in us again. I think we as Democrats have lost faith from too many people, at least in the Midwestern region of our country and these swing districts. I think we have to demonstrate to the American public that we are worth them putting faith in again, and that should we earn that trust and we win back the majority in the House, that we're going to make things a heck of a lot better than they are right now. So, you know, whatever ends up in our leadership structure as Democrats, I think that's very much secondary to what we will make sure that we accomplish for the American public. And I think that's what we need to stay focused on right now, not this whatever the leadership looks like after the November election.
Illinois Democratic Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, thank you.
All right, thank you.
A major reversal for President Trump. At a meeting with top lawmakers and governors involved in agriculture at the White House Thursday, he directed his chief economic advisor and U.S. trade representative to take another look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact. Here's Nebraska Republican Senator Ben Sasse.
The president multiple times reaffirmed in general to all of us and looked right at Larry Kudlow and said, Larry, go get it done.
Last year, he bailed out of the massive free trade deal that aims to counter China and includes major U.S. trading partners like Australia and Canada. A tragic mix-up in the identities of two victims of the deadly hockey team bus crash in Saskatchewan, Canada.
To find out that who they had thought was their loved one wasn't potentially actually their loved one, I can't even fathom, and I don't think enough could ever be said.
Adding shock to tragedy, Canadian officials apologized Monday for mixing up the identities of two of the victims involved in Friday's crash. Xavier LaBelle survived. Parker Tobin did not.
A lot of these boys looked alike. They had the blonde hair that was supportive of their team. And I can't even imagine putting myself in those family's shoes.
Tobin's family thought their son was alive over the weekend and even tweeted, Parker is stable at the moment and being airlifted to Saskatoon Hospital. Meanwhile, Isaac LaBelle was on Instagram telling friends his brother was dead. He followed up on Facebook, writing, All I can say is miracles do exist. The cause of Friday's crash is still under investigation. Canadian officials are reviewing the intersection where a tractor-trailer slammed into the Humboldt Broncos team bus. 18-year-old defenseman Ryan Strasnitsky survived the crash, but is now paralyzed from the chest down. Michelle and Tom Strasnitsky are his parents.
He does keep looking at the picture of the bus, and he runs through in his head where everyone was sitting, and he does have survivor remorse of going, if I sit in there, I wouldn't be here. If I sit in there, I wouldn't be there.
His main thought when he was lying on the road looking at everybody and he couldn't move, he said he wanted to help, and he couldn't move.
To show their support for the families of the victims, some social media users across Canada and even parts of the U.S. have been putting hockey sticks outside their front door and posting photos on social media with the hashtag #StickSout for Humboldt. Don Daler, CBS News, Saskatoon, Saskatchewan.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup.
Autism Awareness Month brings a question. What about using medical marijuana to treat young autistic patients? Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. A new frontier in helping kids with autism. Tampa Dr. David Berger says his autistic patient, Gabriel, had few behavioral problems until without warning he started having panic and anxiety attacks.
Would not stay in the car, tried to jump out of the car while driving down the highway. He had extreme panic attacks over going into public bathrooms because of an intense fear that he had of hand dryers, and he would rather soil himself than go into a bathroom just in case there might be a hand dryer in there for him.
Berger says more traditional treatment didn't work. The boy's parents opted for medical marijuana, starting with small doses.
Because we know if we see something negative, we can stop it, and the next day everything is pretty much back to where they were before.
He says finding the right dosage helped stop the attacks.
And I'd say that in terms of the anxiety and the panic, that he's been reduced by about 90%. I mean, he's just a lovely child now. They can take him places. He's educatable. The family is no longer in fear of him doing something dramatic that might hurt himself or somebody else.
He stresses that this is not about autism itself.
We're trying to treat particular symptoms here, and we're also talking about symptoms that were not controlled by other things that were actually more dangerous to begin with.
In this case and others, Berger says he's combined the hallucinogen THC and another strain that negates those effects.
They're not getting high from it. They're getting wonderful symptom relief, but they're not getting high from it.
He says that worked where other behavioral meds like Ritalin didn't. But parents and doctors need to exercise caution.
So the most important question is, what is the potential benefit versus what's the potential risk versus the alternative?
Florida is one of 10 states where doctors can legally treat autistic patients with medical marijuana. Several medical organizations, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, say there needs to be more research before more widespread treatment for young people. Peter King, CBS News, Orlando.
Cannabis can also be used in other ways, reports CBS News medical correspondent Dr. Tara Narula.
26-year-old Jules Hunt is a New York-based wellness blogger. About 2 months ago, she started taking CBD oil once a day.
You put it under your tongue.
Hunt told us the oil, recommended to her by her doctor, helps her stomach problems and the anxiety that comes with them.
You start to feel the benefits over time, and then you realize, oh, wow, I slept a lot better that evening.
CBD is one of many compounds derived from cannabis. Another is THC, the main psychoactive compound in marijuana. Unlike THC, pure CBD products won't produce a euphoric effect. But Drake University Clinical Sciences Chair Tim Welty says it's difficult to know how well the supplements work. Although limited studies show CBD helps with epilepsy, he says there are potential side effects.
Drowsiness is common, and then GI complaints. Then there's the potential concern about damage to the liver.
Last year, the FDA sent letters to 4 CBD manufacturers alleging some products didn't contain the levels of CBD they claimed to have. Despite the unknown, the CBD industry is growing.
Okay.
Rob Rosenheck and his wife Cindy Capobianco are co-founders of the California-based company Lord Jones. The company's wellness lotion is a customer favorite.
They'll use it for skin conditions from eczema to psoriasis to sunburn, headaches and neck aches, joint pain.
Though Hunt is feeling the benefits of CBD, she doesn't think it's the only reason her health has improved.
A really healthy diet, avoiding my allergens, taking CBD oil, and following the supplements that my doctor prescribed to me.
We spoke to Jules Hunt's doctor. She says the oil is often a last resort for people who have unsuccessfully tried other solutions. Dr. Tara Narula, CBS News, New York.
Motivational speaker Tony Robbins is backtracking on recent criticism of the Me Too movement. Robbins told a female guest at a self-help event he was hosting in San Jose, California, that he took issue with victimhood in the movement. More from CBS News correspondent Jamie Yukis.
During the event, Robbins stood by his comments.
I'm not going to be inauthentic and say I'm sorry about something I'm not sorry about.
But after widespread condemnation on social media, the self-help guru said Sunday he agreed with the goals of Me Too and asked for forgiveness. Sometimes the teacher has to become the student, and it is clear that I still have much to learn.
there's a push in New York City to improve the safety of high-rise homes.
As New York City investigators look into what caused the deadly fire in a Trump Tower apartment Saturday, one New York City council member is pushing for new legislation to require sprinklers in all high-rise residential buildings.
I think it's time that we bring the law up to date to protect New York citizens and residents of the city.
67-year-old art collector Todd Brasner was killed in his 50th floor apartment. The unit did not have sprinklers because they were not required when Trump Tower opened in 1983. In the late 1990s, then real estate developer Donald Trump and others opposed legislation to require sprinklers in existing high-rise residential buildings. But Mr. Trump seemed to change his stance after New York City passed a law that exempted existing apartment buildings. Back then, he told the New York Times, people feel safer with sprinklers. But the problem with the bill is that it doesn't address the buildings that need sprinklers the most. If you look at the fire deaths in New York, almost all of them are in one or two family houses.
Donald Trump has always been a powerful player in this city. And I don't hold him responsible, but he could have been more responsible and let his voice be heard around the safety of New Yorkers.
Saturday's fire was the second in Trump Tower this year. An electrical blaze in January injured two civilians and a firefighter. Meg Oliver, CBS News, New York.
Missouri lawmakers have released a graphic report in which a woman accuses Governor Eric Greitens of unwanted violent sex. He's been charged with a felony but denies the allegations. He's facing calls to resign.
This is a political witch hunt.
Far from resigning, the governor repeatedly said the accusations were overblown and filled with falsehoods.
Over 3 years ago, I made a personal mistake. I engaged in a consensual relationship with a woman who is not my wife. It was a private mistake.
It is the latest chapter in a salacious story involving an admitted affair the married governor had with his hairdresser in 2015, just months before he took office.
He said, I'll make you feel better. I'll make you feel good. Come downstairs.
A report by a special bipartisan investigative committee detailed much of it, referring at one point to testimony which alleged Greitens struck his mistress in the face, taped and blindfolded her, groped her without her consent, and called her a whore. It has prompted legislators to call for Greitens to step down.
I mean, we shouldn't really have a governor that makes this kind of news.
In addition, the St. Louis Circuit Attorney launched an investigation over an allegation that Greitens tried to blackmail his mistress into silence by threatening to release a compromising photo he allegedly took of her.
In February, a grand jury indicted the governor for invasion of privacy, for allegedly taking as well as transmitting that photo. That's a felony. And if convicted at his trial next month, Governor Greitens could go to prison. Dean Reynolds, CBS News, Chicago.
Coming up, a look at Bill Cosby's retrial on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you like this podcast, check out what other podcasts are available from CBS News Radio.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt.
Climate's changing. We contribute to it. I've said that 1,000 times, okay?
Chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez.
That's what this president has always been about. He divides people.
Samantha Bee, our very special guest.
I think I just realized my voice is really boring on podcasts. I'm sorry, everyone.
Not at all. True. Subscribe now for a new podcast every Friday morning. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Russia may have long been planning the nerve agent attack on former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, according to a new letter from UK authorities. More from CBS News reporter Larry Miller in London.
In a letter sent to NATO, Britain's national security advisor says Russia's been hacking Yulia Skripal's emails for at least 5 years. He claims Russian hit squads are trained to deliver deadly nerve agents, one method smearing it on door handles. That's how police believe the Skripals were poisoned. The letter identifies which lab in Russia allegedly manufactured the chemical weapon. It also says Vladimir Putin himself was closely involved in the development of the nerve agent program. Larry Miller, CBS News, London.
After teachers in Arizona began protesting low pay following the lead of educators in Oklahoma and West Virginia, Arizona Republican Governor Doug Ducey has agreed to a gradual 20% raise for teachers by 2020. Correspondent Omar Villafranca looks at what educators have been fighting for.
According to a 2015 study, Oklahoma loses about 13% of their teachers a year to low pay. Many turn to out-of-state jobs.
Over the last 6 years, our teacher shortage crisis has grown exponentially.
Sean Heim is executive director of the Oklahoma State School Boards Association.
Our problem for decades has been we haven't been able to retain teachers because they could drive right across the border.
It zoomed in on me. Let me check that again.
Math teacher Sean Sheehan was Oklahoma's 2016 Teacher of the Year.
Month after month, we were in the red. This is with rent and daycare, before even groceries and diapers. And so we were living off of our credit cards for the longest time.
How about Dunk?
Last year, Sheehan, his wife Casey, who teaches English, and their daughter Scarlett relocated to Lewisville, Texas.
When you crossed over the Red River into Texas, how much more were you making?
We, my wife and I, as both educators, immediately gave ourselves about a $38,000
raise. $38,000
raise? Combined. So two educators, about $38,000.
Special education teacher Robin Edgerton commutes 80 miles a day to her out-of-state teaching job.
I think my first year was over a $20,000 a year raise.
She lives in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, and works in Needles, California. She says she'll never teach in Arizona again.
No one cares in Arizona. Those teachers care. That's why they're there. If Arizona would support those teachers supporting those kids, their education system would change 100%.
Edgerton says she could not have the same quality of life if she had not changed where she works. So does Sheehan.
For the first time in my life, I have financial stability, something I've never known. Finally saving for my first home. It's remarkable.
Omar Villafranca, CBS News, Lewisville, Texas.
Model Janice Dickerson testified to a jury Thursday that Bill Cosby raped her in 1982. After giving her a pill he said would ease her menstrual cramps, she said it instead left her immobilized. Prosecutors used Dickinson's testimony, along with others, to show Cosby had a history of drugging and molesting women long before he was charged with violating Andrea Constand at his suburban Philadelphia home in 2004. She testified Friday three blue pills he gave her knocked her out before he assaulted her. Reporter Matt Piper was in the courtroom and reports on the testimonies of two other accusers.
Shailon Lasha was very emotional on the stand when recalling meeting Cosby when she was 17 at the Las Vegas Hilton. She claims Cosby offered her a pill and a drink and she passed out. Lasha says she was sexually assaulted and that Cosby took her life from her. Janice Baker Kinney says Cosby offered her two pills at a Reno home in 1982. She fell asleep and woke up with her clothes off. Cosby's team is trying to highlight inconsistencies in their stories to police over the years and claims their attorney, Gloria Allred, is trying to get money from Cosby. Matt Piper, CBS News, Norristown, Pennsylvania.
Cosby's first trial ended in a hung jury. He denies the allegations. Los Angeles County prosecutors say they're reviewing a sexual assault case against actor Kevin Spacey. The district attorney's office says sheriff's investigators presented the allegations to prosecutors on April 5th.
The alleged assault took place in 1992 in West Hollywood, and the alleged victim was an adult at the time. The Sheriff's Department says its investigation began in December, and the case was presented to the DA's office last week. A source familiar with the probe concedes the case likely falls beyond the statute of limitations, but says it was sent to the DA's task force on sexual misconduct in the entertainment industry out of an abundance of caution.
I don't think there's any way this 1992 case could be brought today for various reasons.
Loyola Law Professor Stan Goldman.
But it doesn't hurt for the district attorney's office to have a file on a potential sexual offender.
KNX radio reporter Claudia Pescuda in Los Angeles. It's a disappearance that has haunted investigators and advocates for children for three decades, the disappearance of six-year-old Eitan Pates. He left his New York City home for a school bus just two blocks away back in 1979 and hasn't been seen since. 48 Hours correspondent Richard Schlesinger digs into the case against Pedro Hernandez this weekend. He was charged with killing Eitan in 2012. Richard, Hernandez was charged, but is Eitan's disappearance solved?
Well, that's the question. It's an interesting case because Hernandez confessed, but there are a lot of questions about the confession. The defense is arguing that he could have been coerced easily into confessing to this crime.
Well, what have you learned
about his disappearance.
Eitan vanished really without a trace, and there was never a solid lead. So, I mean, this was really old-fashioned police work. You know, they knocked on doors. They asked people if they saw anything. They did all the old-fashioned police work stuff. It took decades, but they say now it's paid off.
What significance did his disappearance have on police work for missing children and these kinds of cases going forward?
It was a watershed moment for law enforcement and for missing children cases. It was Eitan Peitz's disappearance that led to the establishment of the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It really helped focus attention on these cases. And he was one of the first kids to appear on a milk carton, you know. All of that stemmed from this case.
48 Hours correspondent Richard Schlesinger investigates the lost boy. You can watch 48 Hours Saturday evenings on CBS TV or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Finally this weekend, another move could be in store for a long-dead president.
Nearly 170 years after President James K. Polk died, the Tennessee legislature wants his remains to be exhumed and taken to a fourth resting place. Tennessee lawmakers have been debating moving Polk's remains yet again for more than a year. The nation's 11th president died of cholera in 1859. His body was moved twice in the 1800s before his remains and those of his wife Sarah were interred on the grounds of the Tennessee Capitol. The remains may now be moved to the Polk Museum in Columbia, Tennessee, 50 miles away. Jim Krasula, CBS News.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Mitchell Fallon is our intern. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.